Hiya, Wanju. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is a podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and creators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boolu, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded, except when it's not. It's not this week. It's actually recorded in Nam, Melbourne, and it's not an interview episode. It's also a review episode. Nadine Whitney and Virat Nehru are on the ground at the 2025 Melbourne International Film Festival, sampling some of the finest cinema Australia and the world has to offer. In their first conversation out of the festival, Nadine and Virat speak about two films which are pilgrimages of a sort. Casimir Burgess's Iron Winter, a documentary that takes the viewer into land rarely seen, that of the nomadic Mongolian horse herders. An immersive and intimate piece of cinema which invites people to see a dying ancient tradition undertaken on the Mongolian steppes during a five-month journey herding horses to viable snow-covered pastures. Transcendentally lensed by Benjamin Bryan, Iron Winter is almost elegiac. The ravages of the climate crisis are making extreme conditions significantly more brutal, and two young herders have to come to terms not only with the elements, but also with their futures. Remeria by Carla Simon translates to pilgrimage in English. An autobiographical fiction about Simon's parents and the quest for an orphaned 18-year-old woman to find remnants and memories about her father and his family in Vigo, Galicia. Simon's avatar Marina, Lucia Garcia, needs documentation for a university scholarship to study film in 2004. But whether she can convince her father's patrician and evasive parents to accept her as Fon's daughter is complicated by the way he died and their shame. With her mother's diary from 1984 through to 1986 guiding her, she imagines their lives as young lovers. But it is a bittersweet imagining as Fon's family obfuscate truths and misremember because his life has been erased. Again, a film that is spectacularly lensed by Helene Levat, capturing Vigo and its island. Will Marina be claimed or rejected? Will she find vestiges of her parents? Will she be able to prove she is more than a reminder of the hidden ghosts of the past? All of these and much more will be answered in the following reviews from Nadine and Virat, who are on the ground. Right, the spiel from me is that if you want to find out more about the work that we do, then head over to thecurb.com.au or follow us on Instagram, Facebook and Blue Sky at thecurb.au. We are a completely independent ad-free website that lives on the support of listeners and readers just like you. So if you can, visit patreon.com/thecurbau to support our work from as little as $1 a month. And look, if you're unable to financially support us, then consider sharing this review with your film-loving friends. We'd also love it if you could rate and review us on the podcast player of your choice. Every review helps get us into the ears of people who enjoy great interviews, reviews, and discussions. New interview episodes drop on Thursdays with bonus chats appearing on Tuesdays. And bonus reviews appear whenever they want, and which is why you're getting this one on a Wednesday. Right, that's enough from me and my loud voice here before Virat and Nadine talk. Hopefully you enjoy their particular reviews. Make sure to visit miff.com.au for all of your ticketing requirements for the festival, which is still on until the end of August, and there will also be Miff online soon too. So make sure to check those out. Right, enough from me. Here is Virat and Nadine talking about Iron Winter and the other film.
Hello, listeners of The Curb. Today we are doing a Miff missive. Melbourne International Film Festival is well into its second week, and Virat Nehru, who is with me.
Welcome. Thank you so much. And it's good to be at the Church of Cinema.
Yes, has been attending MIF, and I, of course, have given up sleep and sanity and seen much great cinema in our pilgrimage to
the great beyond. And I think pilgrimage is the right word, Nadine, because I think the two films we're going to be talking about today do seem to have that in common, pilgrimages of different kinds.
Absolutely. And pilgrimages based, in fact, well, the first one is absolutely fact, and that is Casimir Burgess's The Iron Winter, which follows two young men on the Mongolian steppes as they go through an ancient ritual to become horse herders over 5 months, battling the coldest winter on record, the slow death of the tradition of the herder, and a reduced herd in itself. Casimir Burgess, who directs this, his previous documentary, Franklin, made an environmental dual time capsule where a son followed his deceased father's journey through the Tasmanian tributaries of the Franklin River. Iron Winter is also a time capsule of something that is ephemeral and dying and environmentally affected, and is captured with an elegiac and sometimes brutal lens by the director of photography, Benjamin Bryan, who I can only give, you know, huge rounds of applause to. So we will start with The Iron Winter, and then we'll move on to our second pilgrimage film. So The Iron Winter follows the 18-year-old Batbold and 22-year-old Sanga as they embark on a 150-day trek to move over 1,000 horses across the Sykia Valley in a search of winter adjustments. And the temperatures drop below minus 40 degrees Celsius and Fahrenheit at night, and taking them in the very beginning and setting up their gur, which is kind of like, I guess, a quick yurt, is Batbold's father and another experienced herdsman who teach them the very basics and then kind of lead them to it. So, Virat.
Yes, this was incredibly moving for me to kind of witness, firstly, the images themselves. I think some of the images captured something I'd never seen before on celluloid, and just the way the horses and the vastness of the expanse of what the harshness of the landscape is doing to them was something which I can appreciate the difficulties of how capturing these scenes would have been incredibly almost impossible. And there is a beauty in documenting that, but also the actual horses themselves were so very cute and funny with funny little haircuts. I know this is not a funny film or a comic film, but I just couldn't help but laugh every time the horses came on screen.
Yes, the Mongolian horse is a breed unto itself, and it is quite a bit shorter in a lot of ways than, for example, Spanish breeds or, you know, American breeds. And they're, you know, they're very hardy animals, and even so, they cannot, and they will not, there will be attrition. There is going to be a section of them who cannot survive the winter journey, as Batbold and his team try to find places where they can just graze, you know, just pastures in deep snow.
I mean, you're made of sterner stuff, Nadine, because my heart was breaking as I was watching these animals brave the cold and realizing that they would come to the eventual end, and watching them perish slowly. And I think there was a part of me which I realize it's necessary to the film, because as you said, this is a film about documenting something which is dying, and death is very much part of this process about, you know, it's the ephemeral nature of life, the circle of life and death. Mm-hmm. And we talk about that, in this sort of the religion that the Mongolian folk religion that they follow. And it's very much about how to escape that cycle to make sure that life and death continue on. But it was still very difficult for me to watch, especially animals kind of dying. It's not something that I can stomach very easily.
Well, I don't believe it was easy for Batbol or Sangha or their father or the other herdsmen to deal with either. At every stage that when they can, because the more they move, the further into the 5 months they go, the worse the weather gets. At every stage, they do stop and grieve the horse to an extent. And they have to, unfortunately, cut the part of the horse's fur. They've got furry heads, but they've got skin. With the brand of the owner, so they take that back. But another thing is, too, these horses are very furry.
They are.
Mm. So it's easy to get confused. And there's something in that, too, that they discuss with a horse's life and the animistic religion that they follow.
There was this beautiful sort of moment where they talk about to break the cycle of life and death, you need to break the jaw of the horse to make sure that the horse's soul can attain salvation and they're not stuck in this continuous cycle and not in this purgatory of sorts. I found that to be quite interesting, how it's capturing these nuances and details about a folk religion I had no idea about until I saw the film.
Yes, well, it's a shamanistic religion that also has, you know, echoes of Buddhism as well, because they talk about reincarnation. Mm-hmm. So the nomads, I think, have picked up, mm-hmm. you know, scattered parts of different religions as they've moved around. And what I took from the idea of breaking the jaw is that it's ensuring that the horse can never have a bridle put in again.
Ah, yes, of course. Yep. And there's what I found incredible about the film, because I was thinking about it, the images are so haunting and, they just stay with you. There is a nobility to the whole process about keeping something alive, which you know that you're fighting against time and inevitability, and yet the nobility of trying to conquer nature, conquer something which will eventually get to you, that, you know, we need to keep the tradition alive. Maybe we are stuck in the past, but we still need to make sure that as long as we can, we keep the tradition alive. At one point, I think the dad mentions that, and I found that to be quite noble.
Well, yes. Actually, that was Batbol. Son talking. The father talks about tradition quite a lot at the beginning of the film, and he's kind of both the young men, the men's mentor, and our, I guess, knowledge entry point into the documentary, because Kaz does not do any talking heads. It's an immersive, you are part of this. So you forget at times that there is a camera even there until the cinematography just blows you away. It's like, oh yes, there's definitely a camera there. Yes.
You do forget at times that the camera is an object present and you kind of, the way the framing works, the vast expanse, and some sparingly and very cleverly strategically used drone shots.
Yes.
To showcase the horses kind of running free. Beautiful, beautiful framing.
Yeah. I think that we just, Benjamin Bryan is a genius, and I believe, too, that they had a lot of trouble when they were coming backwards and forwards to Mongolia. Once they were getting into those temperatures that we can't even imagine, the cameras would stop working because, you know, electronics were just like, nope, not doing it.
I want to expand on the work by Benjamin Bryan there, because what struck me, and this is incredibly beautiful, is there is a certain, especially when you're shooting in the cold and there's this whole tinge of blue and ice and coldness, he's still able to find warmth in the colors. There is this bright ray of sunlight in moments in extremely harsh weather when people are sitting by the fire. There is this warmth, and you can truly feel the warmth because everything else is so cold that as you're watching it, you're like, oh, yes, a little bit of fire, a little bit of warmth. So the fact that he's able to actually give you so much variety in this climate, which just feels blue, cold, and harsh in terms of the color palette, it's quite amazing.
Well, I think, too, what Kaz and Benjamin have done, you know, really skillfully is they do spend quite a bit of time on Batball's very striking and beautiful face as he is contemplating the world, and he is dressed traditionally in the nomadic herder garb, which, you know, it's very, I was looking at them going, they look like really comfy hoodies, blue hoodie and green hoodie, which is very reductive. But they honestly, they're dressed in these beautiful colors and their boots and I don't even know what they're called because I haven't looked into the names of things, but their boots and their hats and their leg socks, which have all been handmade, are just stunning. So you get to see, I guess, a traditional costume of these people who live way away from the center of the economic center.
That's correct. And I think
of Ulaanbaatar.
That sort of gets to the heart of the film and the conflicts that Batbolt is internally facing, which is how long can I continue on this almost inevitable conclusion? You know, will I reach the point where I should just give up? Do I need to come back and do this again? As I'm not only losing the horses and they're dying, but also, you know, my father kind of, you know, can no longer continue on doing this. Other people around me are sort of losing faith and hope, and I'm losing faith and hope as well. And he has a decision to make.
He is only 18, his friend who is 22, so slightly older. And he is, well, he does eventually move to Ulaanbaatar, and I think it's then that the documentary kind of falls down a little bit, because it's not that they don't shoot the city well, and they have, because they do, and there is an incredible shot of him on this, you know, massive, massively scaled Genghis Khan monument.
What a moment. And the camera slowly pans upwards and you see the, just the scale of that monument, and you get to sort of take it all in. I mean, the problem in those sequences especially is you realize that the city is still very sparsely populated. It's not as dense as it might be. So, you know, it is a bit difficult to convey that kind of contrast.
Well, there are more horses, Mongolian horses, than there are people in Mongolia. So Mongolia has a population of approximately 3.5 million people. Mm-hmm. Their animal herding animal population, not just animal population, but herd animal population, which includes goats and bulls and sheep, the like, is at 75 million. So I think that, and that's information that Cass adds on, near the end. So in effect, they're quite agrarian as a culture. What do you see as a Mongolian export? I mean, we don't even think in terms of that.
Yep. But as you rightly said, I think by that point of the film, I think what the film was trying to convey had already been conveyed. And I think it's still sort of the final section of the film still dragged on more than probably was necessary.
Yeah, it just didn't seem to know when to stop. And I think that once you have the protagonist, because essentially he is the main protagonist, shown, you know, in a small room in the city, unable to get work, talking to a previous herdsman who'd also moved into the city, who now works in a knackery, i.e. killing horses, saying, you can never do that. You can tell that he doesn't fit there either. Yeah. So the final, I think, quite poignant shot, and I don't think this is a spoiler for a documentary, I mean, is a really lovely shot of the sidewalks where other people are walking, and there's this dip, very dip into, I guess, not a forested area, but an area with plants and some sense of nature, and he chooses to walk through that rather than on the concrete.
I remember we were discussing when the film ended that there was a logical point where the film could have ended, but it didn't. And it's a beautiful moment of celebration of the Lunar New Year. And it probably, I would have thought that was the logical conclusion as well, as you did as well at that point in time. But obviously the film continues on beyond that. But yeah, I think, what did you think about that moment of people coming together and celebrating and sort of, it felt like, okay, that at that point, the community was celebrating and has come together, and that element and everything that the film had to say was beautifully, almost neatly tied in a bow.
I think that that was a great, really beautiful sequence, because not only is it the completion of their 5 months.
Yeah.
I keep saying it, 5 months in a very, 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 very cold and unforgiving environment, where Batbold has come back and is now considered to have come of age as a man.
Yeah.
And the worries that they had about the fact that they lost at least 10%, if not more, of their horses, and that they would have to pay for the losses, is erased by the community saying, "No, you did a good job."
Yeah,
and no, thank you. Yep. We are proud of you. And
yep, and it was a real Iron Winter. Not every man is able to do this.
Yes, which is something that Sanga says. Yes. to Batbold. So they have become men completely within their culture, but their culture itself, the nomadic culture, is dying, and it's dying because of?
Yep, it's the climate crisis.
It's dying because of the climate crisis.
And I really appreciated that. That point was subtly made. It wasn't really hammered in, but once you watch the film, you can't help but feel the urgency of the climate crisis, and then the backdrop is there. But, you know, Burgess is very smart and clever to make sure that it's always on the undercurrent. It's never really sort of, you know, boldly declared as if, you know, it's...
Yeah, well, I mean...
The film is a lot smarter in how it needs to convey that point, so I really appreciated that.
I mean, a sort of postscript part does say that, you know, the UN has now considered this Mongolia in as part of an emergency state because of the climate crisis. But the way that it is explained before is simply through conversation. So at one stage, I think it's Batbol's father says, humans are more dangerous than wolves. They don't care about Mother Nature. And there's also the line, we can't stop the extreme weather. It's our jobs as humans to live with it. And they're right. Their power to stop climate change is entirely limited. I mean, they're barely, they have iPhones and smartphones, and they film themselves doing tricks and they wrestle and they're very much, you know, just young men. But they're young men in a landlocked country between China and Russia. And, you know, they're still wearing its past glories. And at one point, I think it's Sangha says, you know, we once conquered the world. Now look at us.
That's true. But you made an incredibly important point, which is the fact that we can often become abstract when we talk about the climate crisis in terms of facts and figures and not realize the impact on human beings and real communities. And I think this film shows that. It really shows what the climate crisis is doing in real time to these people and a way of life which is getting erased. And it's not just about melting ice caps or you know, something that is happening all the way over there, and the proximity principle applies. So we don't feel as if it's close, but no, now you can see and you feel this tinge of complicity as you're watching it, because and helplessness in terms of what we're all, you know, helpless in watching that this is unfolding.
Well,
in real time.
Yeah, Mongolia doesn't seem particularly industrial.
No.
And it's trying to be. It's trying to get to that stage where it can be, but it's just, it doesn't have the infrastructure.
Yeah.
So, you know, most of
and,
it.
And I don't think Mongolia is contributing clearly to the level of carbon emissions as some of the other countries. So, you know, but it's facing the impact of it. So, yeah, it's very interesting how the film balances all of these elements.
Yeah, and something you said earlier is something that stuck with me. I feel like I have been invited into a world I have never seen before. But the way that Kaz makes the documentary is to make it feel so intimate that it is explained to me in a universal way. So, you know, that is great documentary making. That's great cinema in itself.
Essentially, yes. I mean, you invite people into a world that they otherwise have no context of or knowledge of, and you walk away after the experience as if you now know a little bit more.
A little bit more and want to find out more. And yeah, so I really did enjoy it. I thought it was very effective and affecting, sorry. But I do wish that he'd kind of found a point on which to end, because it does feel like it loses its steam.
I absolutely agree. I think that the final section became repetitive and the point was made, and the film would have been tighter if those elements were handled a bit better. But still, it doesn't take away for most of the runtime of the film, I was part of that world, I was clued in, and I was just admiring the sheer beauty of what, you know, of those frames were like.
Oh, yeah, the frames are beautiful, but you wouldn't want to be there. You did, you know, it's like, yes, that's lovely scenery, and every frame's a picture, but I'm glad I'm not there. So I think I'm going to just, I guess I've got to do a quote for what I think of the film. I think Burgess's documentary, lensed by Benjamin Bryan is an immersive, touching, harrowing, and educational journey about a life that is going to perish with extreme climate change. It's something I've never seen before, and I felt wholly embraced by it, and I would give it 4 out of 5.
I absolutely agree. I would give it 4 out of 5 as well. And yes, as we've already mentioned, if not for that little bit of the final stretch, this film does everything that it needs to. It accomplishes its own goals that it sets out to. And I will be forever, those images of the funny haircuts with the horses will be now staying with me in my brain, and I'll wake up laughing at odd moments in time whenever I think back, and then people will think I'm a crazy person on the train. So that was Iron Winter, and this brings us to our second pilgrimage film. This is a bit more of a fantasy pilgrimage, but a pilgrimage nonetheless, and of course we're talking about Carl Simon's Romeria.
Which means pilgrimage.
In Spanish. Very subtle.
Yes. This is how we connect things.
So Romeria returns Simon to the subject of her parents, which she first approached in her autobiographical debut, Summer 1993. And this is also a bit of autofiction as well. 18-year-old Marina, who's just about to enter university and wants to study film. She arrives in Vigo in Galicia on Spain's Atlantic coast, and she's on a mission to find out more about her biological parents, who died in mysterious circumstances. And there is a lot of mystery and intrigue about what happened, and she wants to know really what's going on.
Well, as far as mysterious circumstances go, I think what Marina knows exactly how they died, and so does everybody else except for perhaps her very young cousins. But it's not actively spoken about.
Yes.
Until quite a way into the film. And as it's an autofiction, if you know anything about Carla Simon, you know how her parents did pass away. They both passed away during the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Spain and across the world. But that is the thing that Marina, played by Lucia Garcia, who looks so much like a Spanish Emma Mackey.
Yes, indeed.
And this is her first film role. So she's got a diary that her mother wrote in 1984. She has just turned 18, as Verata has said, and she's travelled from Barcelona to... I'm not going to do Spanish accents because that's just really pretentious and I'm not good at them. She's travelled there mostly to be acknowledged as her father's daughter, but, well, by the family.
Yeah.
She goes there to get a piece of paper, which is his death certificate, and finds that she is not mentioned on it. And it is a story about unfolding not so much secrets, because misinformation, disinformation, and hiding a shame that the family seems to think.
Absolutely.
And as she is a result of shame, she has to be in this sort of almost purgatorial space dealing with this side of her family who just mostly doesn't know what to do with her.
Exactly. I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head. This is less about discovering what really happened, and it's not a thriller per se. It's not about secrets in terms of, hey, can we piece it together? And it's not that kind of a whodunit sort of a scenario. It's mostly about, we kind of already have guessed what has happened, but it is about coming to terms with what happened and acknowledging and saying the quiet part out loud, and whether or not the family can actually do it, and whether they have it in them to actually say the words. And And then basically still accept Marina as one of their own.
As yes, and the way that Calcimon has structured the piece is that she uses different quotations as, I guess, chapters almost. And one of the most important chapters is titled Because We Share the Same Blood, paraphrasing, Are We Family?
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, in itself is a big question that Marina is facing, because she's 18, it's 2004, she's revisiting her mother's life in from 1984 to 1986, when she was living in Galicia with her father, Alfonso, just Fon. And she's trying to see the same things that her mother would have seen and her father would have seen, because she never met her father. So she's in between dealing with a very unhappy family.
And a very controlling family as well, because there's a whole idea, especially when we meet the grandparents, and you realize exactly, you know, the problems bubbling under the surface, and they want to control everything in terms of what information can go out, what people think about them, and how they are perceived. It's all about keeping up appearances for appearances' sake, and how important that is for this family, who are very wealthy and very well off, very rich.
Well, yes, I mean the father had a huge boat making shipping yard. The mother, you know, would have been a society queen on the island, on Vigo, and it's, you know, it's a beautiful place. It's a traditional place. And it's also, you know, somewhere where secrets travel.
Yes.
So they really don't want to acknowledge Marina, because if they acknowledge Marina, then they have to acknowledge Alfonso. And that's something that they have quite blanketly scrubbed from their family history. At one stage, Marina walks into a room in the house, and there are pictures of four children, which is her uncle Lois,
Uncle Iago, the two
uncle Iago, who still has some addiction issues of his own, and Olala and Vic, the sisters, and there, as one at one stage, I think it's Uncle Lois who is very much pushing to have Marina brought into the family. Says, "How many siblings were there? How many wealthiest were there to the grandparents?"
Yeah, and it's frustrating because the film tiptoes around the subject matter, which we as the audience already can piece together and know, and yet it takes a long time to actually say the thing that needs to be said, probably a little bit earlier. And I was getting a bit restless, because I'm just like, okay, where is this going? When are we going to get to the eventuality where we would have the confrontation that needs to be had? And that was fundamentally my problem with. I enjoyed the very leisurely kind of approach to arriving at a destination, but maybe it took a too meandering an approach for me to get there.
Well, I mean, I'm never going to say no to Helene Louvart's cinematography,
yes,
especially as she's now doing underwater photography as they dive into the very cold Atlantic Ocean, which is Spain is usually in the Mediterranean and the seas. And just these beautiful, beautiful shots of the different marine life there and the gorgeous bodies of these young people.
Yeah.
Because not only do you have Marina, who is, a beautiful young woman, but her eldest cousin, Nuno, who is played by musician Mitch, is quite handsome as well. So they have these, gorgeously shot bodies, gorgeously shot islands. And within the shooting that she's doing, which looks mostly on 35mm,
mm-hmm.
there's the mix of what Marina is recording herself on a video camera.
Yes.
Because she wants to study
film. And why wouldn't you? You want to go to the Church of Cinema? Because, of course, you would. We know that Carlos Simon became a filmmaker. So, of course, Marina is interested in film. And there is a beautiful sequence in the movie where she is basically waiting on scholarship application from the university to study film. And the grandfather, the extent to the family that the family goes in avoiding to address the truth, basically as a form of blessing, gives her an envelope full of money.
A which huge is going amount to of money.
Was replaced. It's like, why do you need a scholarship? There you go. We've solved it now. And it's not the right approach at all.
Well, I think what he's doing in that scene specifically, because he talks about his wife as well, being very sensitive and doesn't want certain things brought up, is for her to get the scholarship, they have to amend the death certificate to include her as Fon's daughter. To do that means facing the real death, the way that
acknowledging the addiction issues and everything that came
and acknowledging the fact that he died of AIDS and that he had rejected his family's perspective and traditions and fallen deeply in love with this girl from Barcelona. And so, the giving of the money, which she has to thank him for, they stand in a line and the grandfather makes each of the cousins or his grandchildren, kiss him on the cheek after he gives them, I don't know.
Yeah,
whatever, a couple of
token
euros.
Of appreciation. Mm. And Marina gets a whole envelope full of cash. It was interesting to just see the extent the grandparents were willing to go to avoid addressing this issue that we are actually happy to just pay you that exorbitant amount.
It's a bribe.
Yeah, it is a bribe. Very much a bribe.
Mm,
And
she's her mood, which has been fairly patient up to that mm-hmm. stage. And as I was saying, it's kind of purgatorial for her because she's and joyous in some places too, but she's hearing misinformation about her dad and
She thought he died at a different time and realizes actually no, the timeline that she knew was incorrect, and actually he was alive a lot longer than she knew initially.
She has no real idea why her parents broke up until a lot later. But yes, because everyone seems to have a different reason for that, and her uncle Lois, who was in France at the time, so you can imagine the kind of money that this family has. That the all the sons went to boarding school in different places. And he's saying, oh no. She left because she wanted to have the baby in Barcelona. Happened and Marina has her mother's diary, which contradicts what they're saying.
Yeah, so there is this sort of unreliability of narrative, but also no one seems to have the complete story. Everyone has pieces of the truth. And the idea is that she has to then kind of realize that, okay, this is going to be harder than I initially thought in terms of getting what I want. And as the patience wears thin, we finally then get to the fact that, okay, it is not going to be any human that leads me to the truth, but the cat's will.
And which is a veiled reference to a sequence later in the film, which is part constructed memory and part fantasy. Very beautiful and really could have happened a little bit earlier.
Yes.
Because the film
That really drew me back in, but I was feeling a bit lost, and also sort of my patience, Marina's patience was wearing thin, and so was mine at that point in time. And I'm like, okay, let's get to the points.
Yes. And I mean, though, when somebody like Carla is making a film that is a biofiction, essentially, I mean, I imagine it would be very hard to find a place where you would tell her, and that's it. I don't even know if she made this trip herself. I haven't dug deeply into enough of the film. But where do you tell her that's superfluous? An audience doesn't need that when it's part of her, what she believes to be her story, and every aspect that we might find drags slightly for her would have a symbolic meaning.
Sure.
And yeah. So I forgive its
indulgences. Yeah, exactly.
Because of what it is. And again, you know, if you're going to have an indulgent slow movie in places where information is slightly repeated, having, you know, a shot of the sky by Alain Lovart is enough to go, oh, yeah, I'm back in. Paying attention. So, yes, I wouldn't say I enjoyed this as much as I've enjoyed her other films.
I agree.
I think that it's very brave of her to be so raw with her biography because, you know, when you say I am the child of addicts and, you know, I was hidden and, you know, I was wanted, but nobody lived long enough. I was orphaned. It's a really difficult thing to process in itself and then recreate it on film. So I do applaud her for what is, you know, something that's very much stripping.
Yeah,
I can
only imagine how difficult it must be to not only come to terms with the reality of that, but also then sort of have enough distance to be able to then write about it and then make a film which is honest and is sort of, you know, unflinching in approaching your own life, essentially. And there is a lot of shame attached to it in the film. I think the best moments of the film are about how there is still continued shame within the family, and Marina's patience is tested because nobody wants to acknowledge the elephant in the room, essentially. And that was hard. That was hard to kind of watch, but it was beautiful as well.
Yeah, I think Marina, played by Garcia, you know, is radiant, and
she's going to have a very bright future.
Yes, and she's fantastic, and I do think that she plays the complexities of emotion that she needs to display. So, you know, coming into this overwhelming group of boisterous cousins who are throwing themselves into the ocean and being on a boat and, finding this kind of, I can fit in here and have some joy, but also not knowing that she's not really allowed to be a part of that because her mother, who is her, I believe, is her mother's sister, but raised her as her mother, is not happy that she's there. And she has to lie to her grandmother.
True.
She does. On the phone too. Her grandmother doesn't even know that she's on Vigo.
So, she's had to kind of channel a lot of complexity and internalize a lot of these emotions and not overplay the hand.
And, she needs to be apparently grateful for the smallest concessions she is a fully formed 18-year-old woman doing things that she wants, and she has no shame about herself.
Yes. In that sense, I truly was blown away by Garcia, and it was a shock for me to discover it's her first film role, because she looks very comfortable in front of the camera, and she knows exactly how to sort of, the range is already there. So she's a seasoned actor. It looks like it.
Yes. Set in 2004, which is approximately Carl Simon is 38 now, so it was quite well in her own timeline. But there have to be dramatic intersections that are created, I think, for narrative film. And I believe that there would have been at least a few of those within it,
of course.
I would recommend seeing the film. I do think it's exquisitely shot, incredibly well acted, and a very brave and subtle look at, I guess, the shame of. AIDS overshadowing a family, many, many years after it has impacted them. So I would give it a 3.5 out of 5.
I'm going to be slightly harsher. I'm going to go with 3 stars because the indulgence sort of got to me and it sort of tested my patience. But I do agree it's a beautiful film. I'll still recommend it, and I'd want people to watch it because it is a deeply personal story, and the way it's told is beautiful. But yeah, it did test my patience a little bit.
Yes, I think once there is a shift, and the audience, anyone who sees it will know the shift that we're talking about. Once there is that shift into a different space, it becomes immensely powerful. They're two of our reviews, our pilgrimage reviews.
We'll continue our myth pilgrimage.
These are our myth missives because I like alliteration. Our myth messages. You keep talking.
That's all right. It's okay. We'll keep looking forward to. We'll be posting more myth messages.
Myth misses. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peckers.
Clearly.
Peppers, not peckers. Oh my goodness.
Nobody would believe that we are articulate critics after listening to all of this, but it's okay.
That's all right. I don't have to be verbal at 12 a.m.
Yes, but two incredibly beautiful films in very different ways, but both incredibly well shot. Benjamin Bryan, Nealine Bhuvat.
Well, when...
It's the cinematography that really drives both these films in a lot of ways.
I think Alain Lefort is one of the most talented cinematographers on the planet. Yeah. And so, yeah, whenever I see her name, it's like, well, even if the film isn't, you know, top-notch, and and I think she did Firebrand, which was not top-notch, the cinematography was nice.
That's right.
Now, Andrew usually says something along the lines of, The Curb is an entirely reader-supported publication. We would like to keep it free. We will not put things behind a paywall. We are volunteers and lovers of cinema. And if you'd like to keep us going, and if you'd like to hear more and get some special stuff and that kind of thing, please visit our Patreon. And from as little as $1 a month, like, would you even look for a dollar if it rolled under your couch?
Yeah, I mean, especially if it's a big couch, I wouldn't even find it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. You know, change you could lose in your couch, you can give to us, and we will be here making things happen.
Yeah, with a little bit of change, you can create change.
Yeah. Oh, shut up. More mischiefs soon. Thank you, audience, and thank you, Andrew, for having to listen to this and put it up.
Hey, it's me again, Andrew Pierce, jumping in to say thank you very much for listening to this review episode with Nadine and Virat, and thanks to Nadine and Virat for being on the ground to cover these films at MIFF. For all other interviews and reviews, visit thecurb.com.au. Please rate, review, and share this episode with your film-loving friends. We hope they might like it as much as you have enjoyed it. Right, it's enough from me. I'm Andrew Pierce, and I'll see you on the next one.